The Minnesota Court of Appeals is now in session. Judge Hooten, Judge Johnson, Judge Sleater, the Honorable Judge Carol A. Hooten presiding.
Good morning. Welcome to the Minnesota Court of Appeals. The first matter on our calendar this morning is Ray Danielson versus Coronas Parts, Inc. Indeed. The file number is A20975. Counsel, if you will each introduce yourself prior to your argument and identify your client, that would be very beneficial to the court and to this recording. You each have 15 minutes. The appellant will have 5 minutes for rebuttal. And with that being said, the appellant may now proceed.
Can you hear me? I'm having some problems hearing you. That's technology at its worst. My client originally applied for unemployment benefits, and he received unemployment benefits, and the determination of the unemployment people was the employer discharged the applicant during the week beginning 9/29/2019. The applicant's actions were not a serious violation of the standards of behavior that the employer had the right to reasonably expect of the employee. The applicant's actions were not employment discharge. The greater weight of the evidence shows the applicant was separated from his employment due to lack of work. Then thereafter, the employer took another tack, and the attack was that the respondent had voluntarily quit. The problem is these directly contradict themselves. And furthermore, the original determination of the unemployment department was that the applicant was entitled to unemployment benefits.
Now, Mr. Mack, am I correct? You're referring, I think, to your res judicata argument. Isn't it true one of the requirements of the res judicata doctrine is that there's a final judgment? And isn't it true that the initial determination was not yet final?
Two problems. One, you'd be correct, Judge Johnson, if this were a court determination, but it's not. This is an unemployment determination by a department. And the department's ruling, I'm claiming, does not contradict itself, whereas if you had a determination by a court, of course that would be true. But the problem is, one, you can't make a determination, first of all, in response to an unemployment determination, and then contradict yourself directly when you're making another determination saying, in fact, that the person was discharged because he voluntarily quit.
So the argument you're making sounds a little bit more like the concept of judicial estoppel rather than collateral estoppel. In other words, you're challenging not the inconsistency of different rulings by an adjudicator, but rather different arguments made by a party, perhaps.
That's probably correct, or at least different arguments made by the agency itself. And it seems to me that once the agency has decided that the person is entitled to unemployment benefits, you don't get two bites at the apple.
Well, but there's procedures in the statute about an initial determination, and then I think the statute says an applicant or any other person may file an administrative appeal. And then after that decision by a ULJ, either party may file a request for reconsideration. I think the statute says that that the decision is final if there is no administrative appeal or if there is no request for reconsideration. But that implies that prior to that time, it's not final. To me, it seems.
Yeah, but it seems to me that the employer didn't do either. The employer obviously didn't appeal, and the employer didn't ask for a reconsideration.
Well, wait a minute. I thought the initial determination was eligibility, and then the employer filed an administrative appeal to a ULJ. Am I incorrect about that history?
It seems to me that it's fairly clear that a determination had, in fact, been made by the unemployment local people, and that that wasn't appealed. And it seems to me that it stops the employer to say later, we want to appeal on different grounds. Now, with respect to, and I think you're correct, res judicata isn't precisely what I'm arguing, but I think it's pretty clear what I am arguing, that the employer is stopped once it makes a determination from the unemployment people, which is not appealed, that in fact that the there was no conduct that was appealed in this case. The other thing that bothers me is this. The employer out of one side of its mouth says, well, in this case, the conduct of the employee prevents unemployment benefits. And then it comes with a completely different theory a little bit later saying, in fact, the employee was discharged because the employee quit. Now, those are incompatible. I suppose there could be misconduct for an employee saying that the employee quits, but that isn't the case that we have here.
Mr. Mack, can I just clarify your answer? I wasn't sure I understood it from Judge Johnson's question. I didn't see it in the briefing, but is your client claiming that the employer did not timely appeal the initial determination, which allowed for unemployment benefits?
Well, I'm saying that, and in fact, the employer did not timely challenge it, but the employer didn't challenge it at all.
So what is your understanding of how the matter came before the ULJ to begin with?
I think the employer filed a second determination, made a determination that my client had voluntarily quit, and then my client challenged that. I'm having trouble, Judge Hooten. I think you're muted.
I needed to unmute myself, but I'm glad you figured out I was talking. I'm looking at the order of affirmation, and it does say that that there was a motion for reconsideration by the employee, and also there's an evidentiary hearing as a result of the employer's appeal from a determination of eligibility issued on Tuesday, February 18th, 2020. And this is in the first decision, the findings of fact and decision. So there was it appears that apparently that there was a timely appeal by the employer, which the employer is allowed to do.
I don't doubt that. The problem that I see with that issue is that the employer did not appeal on the grounds that that there was misconduct. It came up with an entirely different theory of the case. Now, suppose this was, for example, I shouldn't say that, that's unfair, but say this were a district court decision on an ordinary case. Certainly the appellant wouldn't be allowed on appeal to come up with a completely different theory of the case. Why should they be allowed to come up with a completely different theory of the case when they didn't argue it below?
Well, I mean, why can't they not? I mean, it isn't unusual for even employees when there's an evidentiary hearing to raise issues that weren't raised initially when they filed, because they either get an attorney or they you know, expand the rationale to include other arguments. I mean, is there anything that would prohibit someone from raising whatever issues they feel are pertinent to an evidentiary hearing, including the employee, by the way?
Well, it seems to me that, for example, again, taking our theory from regular court appeals, suppose that a plaintiff loses a case below on grounds X, and then suppose it appeals on ground Y, the court would take the determination that, look, you didn't raise that issue below. So why should an employee be allowed to change its issue or change its fact on appeal that it didn't raise below? Furthermore, and this is important, the employer in this case contradicts itself. On the one hand, it says, hey, there was misconduct. And the determination of the agency is, no, there wasn't misconduct. Okay, we'll come up with on reconsideration on appeal that it was something else, a voluntary quit. But the redetermination is a determination of what was determined below, not a redetermination of what ought to be determined with everything that the employee can come up with.
Well, in the first action was the first evidentiary hearing. I mean, the findings of fact and decision that's in the addendum was the first evidentiary hearing, where there was a full evidentiary hearing where all the issues could be considered. Am I correct on that?
Yes, I don't think there was an evidentiary hearing on the argument that the employee was discharged for misconduct. Maybe I'm missing your statement.
No. You answered it. So you answered my question.
I'm not clear actually on whether the employer made an affirmative argument that he engaged in misconduct. And I have not reviewed the paperwork associated with the initial application, but I'm wondering whether the clerk who reviewed the application initially ventured into the issue of misconduct on his or her own, or whether the employer actually made that argument in response of papers. I'm wondering if you can shed any light on that procedure, Mr. Mayor.
It does seem to me that the employer was allegedly saying that the employee had in fact engaged in misconduct. And I think the record will indicate that when you take a look at the employer's response to the employee's application for unemployment benefits. Turning at last to issue two, it seems to me that once upon a careful determination of the record indicates, my client was clearly indicating to the employer, I was going to be taking a leave of absence because, in fact, I had to have the harvest. And the employer later came back and said, no, that isn't it. We don't have any work for you. The problem is the record is fairly strongly indicative of the fact that the employee was, in fact, requesting a leave of absence and not that he be discharged. Then he comes back and says, okay, do you have a job for me? And the employer says, no, we don't have a job for you because we have too many employees and we don't need you. That seems to me something that an employer shouldn't be allowed to do. If an employee is asking for a leave of absence, and if the employer in this case grants him a leave of absence, then in that event, the employee should be permitted to come back to work. Now, it isn't just a matter of coming back to work at the time the employee asks to come back to work. It's asking whether the employee comes back to work at all. And it's pretty clear in this case that the employer took the position that the employee was discharged and that he would never come back to work.
Well, in the issues you're raising, I mean, even assuming that the employer made a different argument when there was an initial determination of eligibility, wouldn't that be something you could cross-examine the employer's witnesses upon? And then it would be up to the ULJ to decide if it was credible or not.
Suppose the argument is that when a written determination is made by the employer, and that is challenged, that it's the same issue that you come up with all the time in depositions, that a party makes one statement in depositions and that in another affidavit, for example, the employee contradicts it, the party contradicts it. You don't make the determination that the second overrules the first, except in the absence of unusual evidence. In this case, I think that the employer is a stop to argue that, hey, we have may or may not have made the first determination, but now we're making a second determination. And I think that the same rule applies here, that an employer shouldn't be allowed to contradict itself when it's made a written finding to the opposite determination.
Well, and I, you know, in looking at the facts of this case too, I mean, according to the testimony that was given at the evidentiary hearing, the employee just quit coming to work, and they had to reach out to him to find out why he wasn't coming to work. I can see how an employer would think, well, this is, could be misconduct, but in any event, it's a quit.
Problem with that, though.
So does it really, I mean, under this factual scenario, does it really matter? Because the result is, whether it's misconduct or quit, the employee wouldn't be eligible.
It seems to me, though, that my client was attempting to come back to work, contacted the employer, and I don't think the testimony is to the contrary. It's just that he was not allowed to come back to work and was willing and able to come back to work.
Am I correct, Mr. Mack, that you, the evidence you're relying on, the evidence of a leave of absence, relates back to the original interview before he was hired? Is that correct?
In other words,
there was no conversation you're relying on when he took his leave at the beginning of the harvest, but rather you're relying on his testimony about his original interview, basically.
That's true. Unfortunately, I've run out of time, but yes.
No. Yeah, you will have 5 minutes for rebuttal.
Okay. Good morning. May it please the court, counsel. My name is Carrie Phillips, and I represent the respondent, Department of Employment and Economic Development, or DEED. So I'll start with the estoppel issue. DEED issued just one determination on the issue of relator separation from employment. And that's the determination in exhibit number one. It was issued on February 18th, 2020. And this is the determination that the employer appealed, which led to the hearing. So DEED has no record of any other determination. Once we got the relator's brief, we did look through all of our records to see if there was anything that could be construed as a second determination. We couldn't find anything. There was just the one determination that was appealed. And so this matter went through the normal statutory process for challenging eligibility. So before the determination was issued, the parties provided conflicting information in questionnaires. And those questionnaires are in the exhibits or in the record here. The employer or the applicant stated that he was discharged, and the employer stated that he quit. I can kind of read you a statement from their questionnaire. This is exhibit six. It says, what reason did the applicant,
Are these the same questionnaires that were utilized in determining eligibility?
Yes.
Okay, thank you.
Yes, yeah, these are the questionnaires that led to the determination. So the employer said, you know, Ray worked part-time for us and during his employment said he would be leaving early fall to do farm work for a friend of his. They don't say he was discharged. They don't say he was discharged because of employment misconduct, but a clerk did determine based on the questionnaires that he was discharged and for reasons other than employment misconduct. So the employer appealed that determination, stating in its appeal statement, Danielson quit. You know, he told us he was quitting when we hired him. So then the ULJ held a hearing, and in the transcript, the ULJ recognized that there was this factual dispute about quit or discharge. And the ULJ stated two different times in the hearing that the issues included whether the relator quit or was discharged. She then took testimony from three different witnesses. She asked witnesses about statements in the questionnaires, and she permitted cross-examination. So she developed the record on this factual dispute of the separation. And she ended up in her decision making a finding of fact that the relator quit. So it did follow the normal process of an appeal, and there is no other kind of determination out there. So
Ms. Phillips, this case,
yes.
Based on what you said so far, it sounds like the employer did not first mention the issue of misconduct, rather the administrative clerk raised it as a way of saying, not misconduct, or he was discharged for reasons other than misconduct. Am I accurate in the way I'm perceiving your statements?
Yes, yes, you are accurate. My impression is that the clerk, you know, was relying on statements from the relator, and the relator in his questionnaire is saying, kind of, you know, echoing what his testimony was, which was, I was discharged. You know, I called them and they said, we don't have any work for you. So the clerk, you know, based the determination on his statements in the questionnaire. And that's not unusual for a determination to say something and for the judge to come out a different way after the hearing, because that's the purpose of the hearing, is to gather all of the evidence and allow both parties to make arguments. And that's what happened here. So so the ULJ did kind of go the other way of the determination, but both parties had notice of that was at issue.
Ms. Phillips, do you agree with the general proposition that the concept of res judicata does apply to administrative agencies? And though I understand you disagree with its application here as raised by the appellant, what hypothetically, so that I can have a better understanding, in this statutory procedure, do you think res judicata would or could properly be raised?
Sure. I do believe that res judicata can apply to agency decisions. And one way it would apply is if we had issued another determination, if there had been an error, and if we had issued one determination saying that he was discharged, and then that became final, or didn't become final, and we issued a second determination, you know, saying something different. In that case, if that first determination did become final, we would be bound by that, and deed would have to fix that. So if there had been two determinations out there, you know, deed would have been, would not have been able to issue a second one. So that concept does certainly apply to agency decisions. And if that had happened, you know, we would have tried to fix that. So,
if I understand correctly, that would be at the first stage, the administrative level only. So if for instance, a first decision allows for benefits and then within the time period before it became final, reversed itself, that's the only scenario you can anticipate where, and it could go either way, I suspect, but it would, the first of those two decisions would be the binding decision of the department.
Yeah, yes. And I should qualify myself. If the first one had been issued and then deed issued an amended decision before it became final, that would be okay. But if the first one had become final, deed can't issue a second determination, you know, changing it at that point. It's once it's final, deed loses jurisdiction to amend it or change its mind. So in that case, if there had been an initial determination that became final, deed would not be able to do anything about it. So,
and was there any issue in this case that the employer timely appealed that initial determination of eligibility?
Yes, the employer did timely appeal. I have the dates here, but it was within the time, it was within the appeal period, and that was never at issue at any point. So the employer was clearly within the appeal period.
Thank you.
Thanks. So kind of this case comes down to a credibility determination. And the relator is asking the court to reweigh the evidence and find that his testimony was more credible than the employer's witness's testimony, but the court must defer to the ULJ's credibility determination if it's supported by the record. And here it is supported by the record. The ULJ found that the employer's witness's testimony was more credible because it described the more likely series of events. She said that Robin Gray's testimony was credible because it was direct, straightforward, and plausible. And both Gray and Woolman, the supervisor, stated kind of multiple times very plainly that they did not agree to allow the relator to take a leave of absence or promise him that he could return. You know,
now, Ms. Phillips, it sounds like from the testimony, at least in both of the Mr. Gray and I believe Mr. Woolman, that it's fairly common in that industry and in the location for leaves of absence. Although, and I couldn't quite tell if what the ULJ took from that might be like less hours a week versus just leaving as in this case. But would you agree that if the ULJ had accepted the relator's recitation of the pre-hiring discussion, that that would, under the law, have been a discharge and therefore eligibility?
Yes. Yeah, it does all come down to credibility. And a different ULJ may have found the relator's testimony to be credible, in which case, you know, a different ULJ may have found that the employer did agree to a leave of absence. So he was on a leave of absence until December when he called back. And at that point, he was discharged. So
the key, if I understand correctly, and I think this was Judge Johnson's question to Mr. Mack, is the pre-hiring discussion. Because the employee relator says to me, I was understood I can leave in the fall. So he left in the fall and then couldn't come back. So that's your point of the ULJ. And it's purely credibility. And so a different ULJ might have come down differently. And the department would be bound by that decision as well. Or we would be, to say it another way, if the department had appealed.
That's right. These are factual issues. A different ULJ may have gone the other way. It was a factual dispute based on credibility. You know, there was conflicting testimony. And when there is conflicting testimony, the statute requires the ULJ to make a credibility determination and to lay out the reasons for that determination, which the ULJ did here. And the record supports that credibility determination.
And might that explain why an administrative person might approve? Because obviously the relator would have relayed that information that I was told I could come back and then I wasn't allowed back. So essentially by the quote unquote book, a clerk would see that as eligibility.
Right, right. The clerk believed the relator's statements in the questionnaires. So if you look at the questionnaires, you know, the statements in the questionnaires pretty much track the testimony in the hearing. So the clerk did adopt the relator's statements in the questionnaire. And so after the hearing, you know, kind of as we talked about, the judge believed the employer's witnesses and so kind of found the quit. But it is
I assume the clerks are told to do that. In other words, they don't make credibility findings in any analysis. They get the questionnaires from the two and just simply apply the law, presume everything to be true. So unless there's a complete confusion, that's what you believe would have happened in this case per normal policy.
Right. I mean, clerks are required to kind of make quick determinations, quick credibility determinations. You know, they are, but they're not required to explain why they're going a certain way like judges are. You know, judges are required to lay out those reasons. The clerks aren't. So this clerk is the determination is very summary. You know, it's one statement, he was discharged, not misconduct. But they did make that kind of quick determination based on the questionnaires. And then it went to
hearing. Is there any requirement under the law that the ULJ has to give any deference to the clerk's summary decision regarding eligibility?
No, it's a de novo hearing. And that's, I can find the site for you for that, but the evidentiary hearing is de novo. So there is no deference to the clerk, which makes sense because the judge is just gathering, it's a evidence gathering inquiry. So that the judge is just gathering as much evidence as he or she can. And that's pretty much always going to be a lot more than the clerk had. So that's the process, is the hearing allows for parties to really explain themselves and provide all that testimony.
And the clerk doesn't have the opportunity to examine or cross-examine witnesses or actually make an evidentiary record. Am I correct on that?
That's right. Clerks can send follow-up questionnaires. If there is a credibility determination and a clerk is really stuck, they can send out what's called custom fact-finding questionnaires and just ask more specific questions. But it's all done based on questionnaires and also documents that parties submit at that point. But yeah, but they can't, you know, as you say, cross-examine. They don't talk to individuals on the phone. So they don't have that benefit of, you know, listening to people and being able to probe and, you know, ask follow-up questions. So it's just a much quicker decision based on a lot less information.
Is it unusual for ULJ to reach a contrary decision regarding eligibility than a clerk?
No, it's not unusual. It happens all the time. And that's just kind of how the process works. So a lot of times, you know, clerks do their best, but they're doing it kind of as quickly as they can so that people can get paid. And so that first level of decision-making is just necessarily a lot quicker. So it isn't unusual for the ULJ to develop the record and end up going the other way.
Okay, it happens. The way it's set up, either party who doesn't like the decision may appeal and get a full evidentiary hearing. Is that correct?
That's right. Same process for both for either side, employer and applicant. Same administrative process. And then, of course, there's a request for reconsideration, which is the level after the decision, where you point out factual errors or issues with the law. So that's another step, and that happened here, related requested reconsideration, and the judge addressed that and affirmed, and then it goes up to the Court of Appeals.
And it's only the ULJ that can make credibility determinations, am I correct? As between the ULJ and the clerk.
That's right, yeah. Like I mentioned, I mean, the clerk is kind of doing it in essence, but they're not explaining it. You know, they don't have any duty to explain it like a ULJ does. A ULJ has to explain the reasons so that the court can review it and make sure that it's supported by the record.
All right. Any other questions by
if I might, or go ahead, Judge Johnson, I see you have a question.
I was only going to say thank you, Ms. Phillips, for the very concise and well-stated mm-hmm. tutorial on administrative procedure yes. in this area.
Yes, thank you. All right.
Well, I think Judge I think Judge Slater was yielding to me.
Okay. I indeed was. Although I thank you too for that administrative law expose. It's been a lot of years. My question, though, had directly the one issue that, or the last issue, I think that appellant had raised is the non-payment, the retroactive non-payment, and I think if I understood your answer in your brief, essentially that's not properly before us, and actually. Am I correct? It's not properly before a ULJ as well. It just naturally follows statutorily depending on the ULJ's decision. Is that correct?
That's correct. The overpayment is a result of the decision. And we can't compromise the overpayment. It's kind of attached to the decision.
So is there's no agency discretion, or is the point being it's no review of agency discretion and that can be raised?
There's not discretion as far as assessing the overpayment. The agency does have discretion not to pursue it, you know, through collection and so forth. The agency does have that discretion, but the agency doesn't have discretion to say you have no overpayment here.
Do you know if the current commissioner has a policy with regard to collecting unpaid? Like in this case?
Well, I can. In this case, there has been no action to collect it. And I know I don't want to speak for agency policy, but I'll just say that I know that Deed has not been collection actions since the pandemic started. It canceled all of the Minnesota Revenue recapture proceedings. So I know that it is exercising some discretion to not pursue collections, but I'm not sure as far as, you know, the policy on that, but I know that that has been happening.
Okay. Thank you.
Okay. Thank you.
All right, Mr. Mack, you have 5 minutes for a rebuttal.
Yes. Let me first address the last issue. How is a employee going to address the issue of recapture if the final decision of the administrative law judge doesn't allow for any appeal? What I'm saying here is the administrative law judge didn't have before herself the issue of whether or not there should be revenue recapture. The issue was simply made. So it's essentially impossible to develop a record to determine whether or not there should be recapture. It seems to me that that process is problematical because it's unfair. Now, the other thing that I want to point out is in the determination of the agency below, they say, and I'm quoting here, prior to his discussion with Woolman on December 2019, the employer never communicated to Danielson that he no longer was allowed to continue working for his employer in any capacity. I don't think the record says anything like that. At the very worst, the record indicates that the employer said, we don't have any work for you now. But there was nothing in the record that indicates that the employer said, we're never going to give you any work in the future. If the employer had said something like that, that would be an indication that, as the agency determined below, that the employer wasn't going to hire the employee because of misconduct. There's no indication of that. Thank you. Oh, am I muted?
Oh, any questions from any judges? Or did you have anything further, Mr. Mack? Any questions from any of the judges? All right, Mr. Mack, you still have about 3 minutes. Do you have anything further?
I guess I would say that Mr. Gray in the record never stated that he had heard anything about the leave of absence because Mr. Woolman never told him that. But what Mr. Woolman said would really stop the employee from saying anything about it. Then Mr. Gray stated he did not allow Mr. Ray to take a leave of absence and that after the harvest, he still would have a job. This is not credible. Thank you.
All right. Thank you. And thank you for your excellent oral arguments this morning. We will take the matter under advisement. Thank you.
Thank you.